Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
Networking is one of those words that kind of gets bandied about, but the conversation with Tilly, where we dug into what networking actually is, what it really means and how you do it consistently, was fascinating.
I think people are scared of the word, aren't they? It's a bit like, do you remember when we used to work in the bank, role play? Role play would scare the poo out of people.
Yeah. So then conversation rehearsal.
And it's funny, isn't it, really? Because networking is basically just chatting. And the only purpose is to say hello and maybe build a relationship. You know, that's it. It's not quite as scary as people think.
The connotations of networking is it's almost steeped in being self-serving.
You know, yes.
You're going to try and meet people that you can sell something to or get something from. Whereas Tilly's approach is, I'm going to learn. She was learning an opportunity.
Brilliant.
And I think that the stepping stones that she's used through her childhood, her school years, and where she is now gives a real strong insight as to why she's so successful early on in her career.
And for me, it's that just thing where she's just going to have a conversation with someone. But I love the fact when she said, you're doing it all the day with the new patients anyway, who you've never met. So there's no real difference. It just happens to be you're in a different position, dentist to patient as opposed to dentist to dentist. But brilliant. I thought it was great.
Just quickly before we get into this episode, if you enjoy and you could subscribe, that would be brilliant. We send out new episodes every Monday at 7 o'clock. And if you enjoy it and you want to share it with somebody, that would be amazing as well. So now let's get into the episode.
Thanks very much.
Here we are again.
Yet another Dentology podcast.
I love them.
Don't we love them.
They're good ones, aren't they?
I think it's interesting because the people are more interesting than us, and that's why we're all getting that. It was 120 plus now, isn't it?
Our 120th episode went out this week.
And not a single duffer.
No. We've had
no pressure.
And I was going to say, good one after good one. So there's no pressure for today's guest. And today we are very, very fortunate. We're joined by Dr. Tilly Houston. And Tilly's a dentist, networker extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire, I love that word.
And a positive force in dentistry. Welcome, Tilly. How are you doing?
We don't have to say, Houston, we have a problem. Oh, I had to get that in. But you've had that all your life.
Yeah, no. Very original. Morning, guys. Thanks for
the
introduction. Pressure's on then. 120 plus.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And no duffers.
And no bad ones. And we don't want to start now either.
Okay, right. I'll try my best.
Focus. Oh, connection's gone. No.
So to kick off, Tilly, I think it's always useful but interesting to find out kind of the background of people. And it's often said that PPE has had the biggest impact on our lives. And every dentist listening will be, oh, PPE, yeah, we know about that. But in this context, it's parents, postcode and education. And so that's kind of the start point. So what was your family upbringing like? And were you always destined to be a dentist?
So interesting one. No, absolutely not destined to be a dentist. My parents didn't go to university. They're kind of completely not medical at all. And actually no one in my kind of immediate family were medical. Grew up in Southwest London and went to school there. I actually went to school a year early. which I always say to my parents, I've had a year less of life where I can just live and not have to be in education and working.
Why did you go to school? Why did you go to school a year early?
I don't know. I think
something your parents was to get rid of you.
Yeah, I think something like that. They'd had enough of me after 2-3 years. and so
which month were you born in, Tilly?
November. So I was earlier in the school year. So started school when I was in Wimbledon and then stayed there for a couple of years. And then we moved out to kind of Surrey area and then continued kind of in the year above, I guess, when I went back to school. And then I think my parents decided, do you know what? Actually, there's no benefit to her being kind of a year ahead. All her friends are going to be able to learn to drive before she can.
How did that work?
Well, so then basically, I think it was when I was in year six, I came out of school and went to a completely different school just for 1 year to repeat year six. which
okay.
at the time I was so nervous, and I was like, why are you making me do this again? I just didn't understand the time. It's like, life's so unfair.
Wow.
It was such a great year because it was, it kind of, to me, didn't really mean anything. It was just for fun.
It was a free year.
Yeah, exactly. And it was great. But then what was really hard was then coming back into the school that I was in the year below, and all my friends were in the year above. And at that age, like one year difference is quite a big difference, kind of age.
It's huge.
11, 12. So that was quite a challenge.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Because I was, when I went to my secondary school or my school, whatever you call it, I don't know, I was in a year above. So therefore, when I came to end my school, whatever's year, is it year 12 or 11, whatever it is, all of my friends left.
Yeah.
So I had to stay on.
Oh, that's hot.
So at the end of the year, there were four of us.
Oh my God, that
it was mad. It was mad. The world's smallest school year ever. Hello. But it was hard work. It was hard work because you're sort of not in your right position, are you? It's quite strange.
And I think school's tricky anyway because you're kind of growing up and finding out who you are. So to then have something like that chucked in the mix as well.
And prom.
Yeah. Yes.
I suppose prom. Did you have prom? Because they're all your friends doing prom and you're like, oh, okay, I can't do prom.
It was honestly such a weird one because you'd see them around the school.
Yeah.
Hi, but almost felt like I couldn't be friends with them, but that I had to make an effort to be friends with the people in my year. It was weird. I mean, it was fine after a term or so, I kind of got into the swing of things.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, they're all kind of off going to university and off doing their own
thing.
And it's weird.
And who was your friendship group, Tilly? Was your friendship group the year that was above you or the year that you were then in?
So I think I formed closer friends with the group that I was then in. Friendly with the guys in the year above, but my close-knit group who I'm still like really close with now were in that year that I then moved into. But I think
I
think the friendships maybe when I think I found it quite hard because when you're that young, like 4, 5, 6 and 8, the friendships are almost just because they're people that you're in a class with. When you get a bit older, you have a little bit more kind of working out who you are, who you like, and who you get
older.
And so I'm actually super grateful to my parents that they did that. They did that kind of swap again when it was earlier on rather than later on.
It's sort of early. I know that we talked about networking extraordinaire. It's sort of almost like a formulation of an early networking plan, isn't it? You know, because you've sort of got to get on with various people. You don't recognize it at that time, but basically if you hadn't, you'd have probably shriveled and died. But you were having to sort of relate to people that you used to relate to, people you never related to, people in that one year that you're never going to see again because you just rocked up for a year. It's quite an interesting sort of,
I think it's intriguing,
basis of maybe where you are and do what you do now.
I don't think it's a coincidence that you adapted young
and fascinating
to a new group of people, and we'll come on later talking about kind of how networking is a theme of how your career has progressed as well. But I don't think that's a coincidence.
No,
I think
not that at all.
A skill that you acquired quite early on. And I think also for people listening to this that might have kids and young kids, to listen to your experience, I think it will be fascinating because everybody's kind of, you know, wanting to make sure they create the best environment for their kids possible. Mm. But actually your environment, whilst when you were young, might have felt quite challenging, you learned to acquire some skills very early on that have served you really well.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone who's, I've heard people, you know, been put up a year and stuff like that and start a year early, a bit unusual, but I've never heard anyone who has then gone to another school to do a year,
like a whole
to then pattern. Leave that school to go back to the school they did. I mean, I've never heard that.
No.
I've never heard that.
It was, I think, look, I mean, like I said earlier, at the time, I'm like, what are you making me do?
Yeah.
Go to this random school for 1 year. But actually, the school that I went to, my parents kind of thought, well, rather than making her do literally the exact same syllabus again, completely like immediately with all the students from the year below, why not take her out, give her a completely different experience? And the school that I went to was quite different to the school that I'd been at, and it was kind of like calling all the teachers by their first names. It was much more relaxed.
Oh, wow.
Right, yeah. But
she'll probably get a slightly different experience, maybe like learn a different set of skills, maybe non-academic skills, but like you guys said, kind of interacting with different people and that kind of thing.
What did your mum and dad do for jobs?
So they're completely non-medical or science-y. My dad comes from like a managing consultancy background, and my mum actually used to work in like TV and film while we were growing, and then moved to kind of marketing, that kind of thing, later in life.
I was just wondering whether their experience made them think sort of outside the box for their child's education. I'm just thinking, well, your dad is a management consultant. It's just interesting as to what they were doing.
Yeah.
Because what was their motivation to think about it? Because I've never heard anyone else do it.
So what was the twist for you for dentistry? And when did you decide that dentistry was your calling? Because there's no experience back there. And so far, it's not come up at all as a word.
So I think it kind of came when we started to do work experience, and school was saying, right, you need to go and do a week's work experience somewhere. And I was like, oh God, I don't know. I don't really know what I want to do. Maybe I want to do medicine. I knew I kind of wanted to be helping people. So I went and did a week's work experience, like in a GP in a hospital. And I really didn't like it at all. And then I was suddenly thinking, well, that was the only thing I thought I would really do. So where do I go now? And one of my friends who I used to swim with, her dad was a dentist, and he was like, oh, come do a day with me. No one really ever has a burning passion to be a dentist. Just come do a day with me and see how you think. So I remember going along, and he had me mixing the alginate, and I was suction.
Oh, wow.
I mean, probably he's retired now, but well, after you've retired, hope I'm throwing him under the bus there. But yeah, like was suctioning and kind of really getting my hands involved. And I loved it because it was so practical. Mm. And I just saw it as a big social kind of every day. He'd go in, talk to lots of different people. Not much dentistry was going on. It was more just like the chatting and the relationships I'd seen that he'd built. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. And I ended up doing more days with him. And without kind of consciously making a decision that I want to be a dentist, I ended up just going down this pathway of being kind of more work experience, then the GCSEs and A-levels that I needed for it. But look back since, really. So I've got him to thank.
Yeah. Wow. We hear time and time again that it's work experience that turns people's heads towards dentistry.
An individual, isn't it? Yeah. One person who
really sparks
your journey.
Yeah, something happens. And I wonder whether more could be done with younger people to get them interested in dentistry. And I think part of the challenge is that now you need to choose your GCSEs when you're 13, 14 years old. And that then sets you up to do your A-levels, which then sets you up for your entry into dental school. So the decision has to be made so early. It's hard for young people to get that exposure to dentistry, definitely, to give them a chance.
How do you know what you want to do? It's hard, isn't it?
My sister's going through it kind of at the moment. She's in her third year of uni. And even going to uni, she was like, I don't really know what I want to do as a job. So what degree do I do? And I just said to her, just do something you enjoy and it will work itself out. Mm. But now she's still like, oh, there's nothing. She always says to me, you're so lucky you knew you wanted to do dentistry because you kind of just follow a pathway that's set for you. Whereas when you don't know what you want to do, it's really tricky. I felt a bit like kind of the other way around, as in, I've never really had to think for myself, or I just knew, right, next pathway is uni, then FD, then, and you know, it's kind of for you, but no, it's interesting. But yeah, I completely agree. It's not really on your radar when you're making those decisions as a job. And actually, I remember my mum saying, because she used to work in television, she found it really hard when she had when she had her children. She really couldn't keep doing her job that she loved. It just was almost impossible for her. And by the time she came back having children, she kind of fallen out of touch with what was going on and couldn't really join back where she was. And so she kind of just had in the back of her mind saying to me, look, really, when you're thinking about it, do think about if you want to have children, want to have a family, something you can kind of do perhaps alongside.
And dentistry is great for that. Isn't it? In terms of working, you know, one or two clinical days a week, that suits lots of people.
Yeah, exactly. I'm loving it so far. So far.
Good, yeah. Good. So you graduated from Bristol in 2020.
Yeah.
Top student. Well done for that.
Well done, yeah.
It's very smart. Obviously, part of your...
How many students?
It'd be interesting to get your take on your overall experience. Obviously, it was COVID impacted as well. So what was it? Obviously, for most of it, you COVID hadn't arrived, but then I guess for your last year, it did. So how did that kind of work out for you?
It was crazy. I think luckily our year just kind of got out of uni just in time. It was the year below that really got hit, because we'd actually sat our written finals in the January, and in March, going on study leave to do our kind of vivas. So we went home on study leave in March and never came back. It was so...
Wow.
Because then lockdown hit, and then we were just at home.
When did you have your final graduation, or when did you finally have your graduation?
So that was actually lovely. We had that 2 years later, so we had that 2022. It's a little strange because years below us had graduated before us. It had been and gone, and we were like, hang on, this isn't fair. But actually it was so nice because it was like a reunion, and everyone had kind of been and done their FD and was doing kind of different stuff, and it was so lovely to catch up with everyone. And you know what,
out of interest, Tilly, was it a separate one? Did you like have a separate, or was it crammed in, was it added to the existing graduation, so that graduation like took forever? Or did you like have a separate COVID graduate session? Because I'd imagine if, you know, trying to add all those COVID graduates and we're here for the next 8 hours
hours and hours. I do remember that kind of couple of months that summer, it seemed to literally be graduation 10, 12, 2, 4, like every couple of hours every day.
Yeah.
But I think it was a dentist and a few others. Clapping for a long time, but I don't think it was any longer than enough.
It's very sore hands, or the polite. Your mum, if she'd have been in TVO and TV and film, she probably was able to tell you how to look like you're clapping, but don't really hurt your hand.
Going back to the networking thing and your school days, were you very social at dental school? Did you carry those skills through and have a large sort of network of friends at school?
I think so. Well, at dental school, I think...
Yeah.
Do you know what? Our year, we got so lucky. We had, honestly, the best year. Everyone had their own little friendship groups. Because our year was quite small at Bristol, there was about 60, 65 of us. You knew everyone, first name, surname. You could sit next to anyone at lunch and have a chat with them. And
that's great.
Generally, everyone got on really well, which was so nice. It was kind of just like one big group. Obviously, there were little groups within there. But I know, kind of looking at other years, there was a little bit more kind of distinct groups that wouldn't mix so much. But I honestly had such a great time at uni. Like it was fantastic, and everyone was so lovely, so supportive. And all the staff knew us as well, which was really nice. So yeah, yes, socially, I mean, Bristol is great for social side of things anyway. I think it actually became more social for me and less academic, as kind of friendship groups went through uni.
I love the sort of
are you one of those people that's quite naturally academically gifted, in that you just absorb new material quite quickly as opposed to have to really dig in?
I thought maybe, but no. And actually, I think I work so hard during uni, and I remember the hours, especially kind of the first couple of years, I would sit literally each night going through my notes. It wouldn't just be something that would I would read it and it would stick. I'd have to really work at it. But I think kind of going back to the starting school a year earlier, I think I take kind of that work ethic, I guess, from being in a scenario where you're with other kids that are almost a year older and having to really work hard when I was younger. I think that's where it's
interesting.
So we're never pushy, really, like, not pushy at all about working hard, or they kind of just let us do our own thing. So I think that came from, that kind of early start, I guess.
Right, yeah. And so then you graduated. So you say you did your finals in January 20, lockdown hit March 20. So what did your foundation year look like?
So I think different to what it had been like before. Actually almost a blessing in disguise, because we'd come off clinics in March. We'd not touched a drill for however many months that is until September. Plus, they're new graduates, so our skills are a bit shaky. muscle memory, right? So we were kind of going into September. I was so nervous. I was thinking, God, I've not done a crown prep. I don't, not even done a filling. Like, am I going to remember what decay looks like? the blessing in disguise was, at the practice that we were at, they were building a new surgery, and it was the first year that they were taking on two of us FDs. But because of COVID, the building work wasn't finished. So there was two of us FDs, but we had one surgery. And what it meant is that we were doing kind of half days and nursing with each other, which for me, initially, I was like, oh, it was the best thing, because it just gave me that slow start and I could...
Yeah, that's good.
Much together. And it just let me find my feet in a little bit more of a kind of relaxed, supported environment. I found coming out of COVID, that actually was the best way for me to start, rather than diving in head.
All that PPE stuff. Do you remember? What was that? What was that thing that, you know, the, I don't know, when you had to wear the, you had to go and get your hood fitted and all of, you know, all those. Yeah, you know, it's all that sort of, you forget about all that, don't you? I have to have a window open and was it an aerosol, wasn't it? Aerosol, 30 minutes and all that.
So cool.
Yeah.
And I remember all the men who had facial hair would bought this very unique kind of, where they could just about manage a little bit of moustache hair.
Yeah.
But because of the mask, they had to be clean shaven. It was, it was an interesting time, wasn't it?
Well, I remember people telling us, didn't I? I mean, it must be fascinating as an FD going, in a way, probably a really brilliant experience, because you were working at, this is not going to sound how it sounds, so forgive me for private practice, but you somehow imagine for an NHS practice with an FD student, it is going to be like the following the PPE Corona protocols to the nth degree. So you know, you're going to be suited up in your big old outfit. It's probably a really good learning experience, I'd imagine.
It was crazy, coming from nothing to suddenly, we had this donning and doffing station where you'd...
Yeah, that's it.
Ours was literally in reception. And I just remember, like, and, like, hair nets and the poor patients in reception looking at us, literally terrified at what we
could say. I'm going to die.
Well, it was like full-on theatre scrubs almost, wasn't it? And like, literally someone's got toothache.
Yeah.
It's like, what's up?
You're going to be there. What's going to be brilliant is Tilly's generation of dentists in about 20 years' time, when you've got your students moaning about stuff, you're going to be going, look, you don't remember the days of, it's a bit like, do you remember the war? Let me tell you what I had to do as a foundation dentist.
And then in a fairly short period of time, you now work as an associate across three different practices. And you're very active in the BAC, the British Academy of Cosmetic Dentistry. And you said that all of your jobs came as a result of your connection to the BACD, which goes to serve that you are a network extraordinaire, because that group has led to opportunities. And what does building a strong network actually look like and mean? Because it's not just turning up to parties. It's not just being seen. You actually have to have a, consciously, you have to build a network. So for people out there like young or old, how do you build a network in a way where it's truly useful for you? Yeah, because this has led to jobs. This has led to, you know, gainful employment as a result of that.
Just sycophantic backslapping.
Exactly, exactly.
I love the best thing about being a dentist is chatting to people. So it's my favourite thing is chatting to people, learning about people and having a genuine interest in other people. And everyone has something that you can learn from. And I think for me, I guess that's probably the most important thing. I guess it's not something like, right, I'm going to go and network. Let's go. I don't put a hat on. It's just having conversations with people, but showing an interest and caring what they have to say. And I guess also the dental community is so small that you end up, if you go to a few events and you put yourself out there and you speak to people, and I guess it's going up to people and just saying, oh, lovely to meet you. My name's I do X, Y, Z. What do you do? And just, I don't know, I think from speaking to other kind of younger dentists, a lot of people are nervous to go to events for the first time because they're like, I don't know anyone. Who am I going to talk to?
And we've all been there. We have all been there. That walking into a room of faces you don't know is awkward.
I love Tilly's. He's just going up to someone.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people listening to go, I can go up to someone. I just go up to someone and say, hi, my name's Tilly. This is what I do. What do you do? And I think a learning for people listening is,
you can do that.
Yeah. But get it out of your head that they're going to be horrible.
Dentistry is a friendly profession.
People aren't horrible when you do that, are they? They don't blank you down.
I remember going to an event where people were nasty or didn't want to talk.
No, everyone's up for a chat. Everyone, you all have something in common. So it's so easy to strike a conversation with anyone. But also, as a dentist, it's literally what you do. Every day, a new random person comes and sits down in front of you. You say, hi, my name's Tilly, and you strike up a conversation with them. So we're naturally doing it every day. And I always think...
That's a great one. But also... That's a great soundbite. Sorry, just thinking, that's a great soundbite, actually, for people who are listening, who are nervous, is the fact of... You're doing it already.
Every day.
It just happens to be your position as your dentist to patient, as opposed to dentist to dentist. And it's a great one. So anyone listening, you are doing it. You're doing it 10, 20, 30 times a day, however many patients you see.
But also I think it's not just, I think there's a difference between kind of just bouncing around an event, saying hello to people and actually building a network and keeping in touch with them and having deeper conversations and taking interest. Because I think kind of just being open to the idea and having the right sort of demeanour and personality will start those conversations.
Yeah.
But I think a network, what you've developed is beyond that. So you've obviously stayed in touch with these people and you have ongoing conversations and you talk about things that are interesting to you and the other people. And I think that's different from just kind of chatting to lots of different people at lots of different times. Yeah. That's not developing it in the way that you have.
It's a skill. It's a real skill.
I think it does come down to just being interested by people. And you know, sometimes you can tell when you're talking to someone and you kind of feel like they're not really listening to the answers that you're saying and they're just talking to you for the sake of making polite small talk. I think to form kind of meaningful connections and relationships with people, you have to be interested. I remember Samir Patel actually always, because he is such a great networker and communicator, and he always said to me, when you are speaking to someone, literally forget about everyone else. They are the most
important. Don't look over their shoulder.
Yeah. They are the most important person. You have to focus on them, really listen to what they're saying, not just to reply, but listen to what they're saying. And I find that kind of really, really helps me. Yeah, I don't consciously think so much of that anymore. But it is important with social media, and there's so much going on. Everyone's got so much going on in their mind, just to kind of put your mind. And I do it with patients as well. It's easy to be thinking, oh, this is what's coming up later in the day. Oh, I need to get this. Forget all of that. You've got one person in front of you. Just give them your attention, your time. And I found, as far as kind of building relationships with people and keeping in touch, it's powerful and it works, I guess.
Makes them feel special.
Yeah, and I imagine that's probably filtered through to the interactions you have with your patients as well, in terms of understanding their needs. Because what you said is right. Most people, when you're talking, they're just waiting. to for a gap so they can start talking. They're not really listening to understand.
Yeah,
they assume they know what you're going to say. Yeah. And I guess in your world, some of the clues and things that patients might say give you a deeper understanding in terms of what their needs are. Perhaps not clinical needs, but aesthetics or how they feel about coming to the dentist or what their worries or concerns might be. And hanging on to those things is quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the kind of non-clinical side of things, getting to know that person. Everyone, you always hear kind of don't treat a stranger, get to know the person. And I really think that's so, so important. Get to know the, you're about to put your hands in some stranger's.
Mm.
I want to know a little bit about before I do.
It's crude, isn't it?
It's like true. Was it Barry Alton who said something like that? He sort of says, I never really thought about it. He said, who else puts their hands in your mouth?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I never thought about that.
And also, like, their head is literally between your legs. Like, where they are is a very vulnerable position. You're then putting your hands in their mouth. It is a lot. And it's, I think, for making them feel comfortable as well, just getting to know a little bit about, I try and find some similarity or something that we can be like, I've got a cousin who whatever, just to make them feel a little bit more relaxed. But honestly, the nurses hate it. They're always rolling their eyes or like tapping their wrists, like, get on with it, we're running. The nurses I work with, they're like, you talk so much. I'm like, I know.
That's good. So you work across three practices. You've obviously got a growth mindset in terms of you're always trying to find new things, do new things and better yourself. Is that part of your logic to working across three practices? So you get different experiences and it gets you to learn and acquire different skills?
So I think yes. And initially I was working at two and I was learning such, one was kind of a private practice, one was a mixed practice, but with a more heavy private aspect to it. And just from, forget the dentistry I was doing, just the way that the practices are run and the different different bosses and the way the reception was run and the nurses taught me different things. You learn so much. And also from the patients, different demographic of patients like to be, I don't know, spoken to or treated in a slightly different way. Or I've learned to deal with slightly more difficult patients in one area or someone with higher expectations in another area. And I think it was just getting like quite a broad base of learning as much as I can. This other opportunity came up more recently. And I thought, cool, the amount I can learn from this, I can't say no. So at the moment, I'm on a bit of a just saying yes to everything. And I've honestly, learned so much from the different practices, different bosses. Three practices is a lot. And sometimes I wake up and I'm like, okay, where am I going today? Have I got my loot? But no, as far as kind of me developing as a clinician and working out what sort of dentistry I want to do, where I want to take my career, it's so hard initially to know what you want to do. And I had students saying to me, oh, I don't know if I want to specialize in this yet. And I was like, just do a few years of doing a bit of everything. You'll quickly learn what you love and what you don't.
Yeah.
There's no rush. And I think at the moment I'm just enjoying keeping trying to do as much of everything as possible.
Right. Okay. Andy says a thing that I've heard him say a few times. He says, you know, when you're starting, it's really good to say yes to everything, because as you get older and you learn, you can then start to say no to things.
Yeah.
But if you say no at the beginning, one, you don't know what you've missed. And two, people stop asking.
Exactly. I would completely agree with that. I think you don't know if it's a good opportunity miss unless you do it and say yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the future, I don't know whether that's something that you want to do again.
And even if it turns out to be not great, you will still learn. You'll still take something from it. And even if the thing you take from it is, I didn't enjoy it, I don't want to do that again, at least you know based on experience as opposed to what somebody might have said to you about it. Yeah. You said you've used a word like learning, development several times. You obviously go on lots of structured courses as well. So you're effectively stacking your skills in terms of the things that you've got in your armour, your toolkit. Obviously, you have a requirement to deliver a certain amount of CPD in a year. And CPD is continuing professional development, but I think it could almost be clinical professional development because most dentists spend all of their time on clinical courses. Do you kind of balance out between non-clinical learning as well as clinical? Or are you still in that phase where clinical is where you're kind of doubling down on?
Yeah, I think especially so early on, naturally you're like, right, I want to go and learn how to do composites. I want to go and learn how to do all these things because you feel like your skills aren't good enough yet. So you feel like that's what you need to improve. And actually, when I started my job with Rajiv Rawala and Amika, they said to me, right, there's a course that we really recommend that's to do with learning about how to do a checkup, like a patient exam. We want you to go and do it. We really recommend it. We've done it and we think it's invaluable. And I remember initially being like, why do they want me to go and do a checkup? The easiest part of dentistry, surely. But actually, so I went on this course and they said, look, 50% of your day or less or more is checkups. You will not do any of the treatment that you want to do. You won't be doing composite bonding. You won't be doing Invisalign. You won't be doing crowns or anything. If you can't talk to a patient initially about get them to book in for the treatment. So the first hurdle in every treatment that you do starts with a checkup. So if you can
really good point. First step,
yeah, very good point.
10 out of 10, then you're going to have patients booking in for the treatment and then get good at that treatment. But if you get 10 out of 10 at composite bonding, but no one's booking in for it, then what's the point?
There's no point.
And so I went, probably one of the best courses I've done was this PYP course, and really, really intense. And they break the checkup down into 18 steps, I think it is. And it's all about how you deliver your checkup, communicate with the patient and take them through that checkup appointment, and it has completely changed the game. Like, that was probably one of the most pivotal kind of courses I've done, and as far as me being able to speak to patients and also me having some kind of continuity and not doing a different checkup for a different person. Every dentist, if you just go and watch dentists doing a checkup, everyone does it differently.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's roughly kind of similar things. Everyone does a charting and a VPE, but the way they go about it is so different considering it's checkup.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that
you have to be open to it, though, don't you? Because I think one of the other things is, you know, even you at your relatively young clinical age, there might have been a bit that says, well, you know, why do I need to go on a course about an exam? You know, why do I need to do that? Whereas you can imagine some older dentists would. You know, I can't believe you're making me go on a course. But by the sounds of things, it was a brilliant course, as you say, to give you continuity, if nothing else.
What interests me is that of all the courses you've done, the one that you kind of said was the most valuable was actually a non-clinical course.
Yeah.
I guess it was more about structuring the surgery, communication, having the conversation, planning. You know, like you say, it wasn't about getting, you know, a superb outcome on the look of a composite, which there's endless courses for that. And we met fairly recently at the Dentorama event, which was great fun. And that was effectively creating a theatre style situation that kind of got played out in real time. And then we had to kind of, you know, observe and decide kind of what went well and what went badly. And much of it was about communication. And either, you know, not getting consent or lack of communication or not kind of, you know, giving people the free information. The course that you've just described is about communication. We've had specialists on, people like Barry Orton, talk about communication. Does communication get the airtime that it really needs in dentistry? And is that something back in dental school days that it got kind of highlighted to you, the importance of it?
So, no. Is the short answer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to you. Next question.
At uni, I mean, it's hard, right, to teach communication. And I guess they're trying to make everyone a safe beginner and so focus on the clinical skills. But I remember uni communication sessions, and you have an actor coming in, and it just feels so forced and, I don't know, the actor's kind of going extra angry. And I'm just like, no one in
a
scenario would talk to you like this. I honestly think part of it is just quantity, just speaking to loads of people, getting
10,000 hours.
Yeah, 10,000 hours, just and a diverse group of people, because there's so many different kind of personality types. I did a great course very early on, another communication one with Jane Sproson, about, because I was speaking to everyone how I like to be spoken to, kind of like quite upbeat energy. I would get some people and they come into the clinic and be like, hey, how are you? How's your? And they'd be like, yeah, good. And I'd be like, oh, they don't like me. There's something wrong. They're not same energy back. And actually, he taught me quite early on the different personality types. And actually, those people don't want to be spoken to like that. And now I'm so better at reading a person, kind of chameleon effect, them, how they want to be spoken to. And it's actually quite exhausting, just having that the brain switched on and trying to analyze someone. And, but it makes such a difference. And dentistry is so much easier when you get on with the person you're treating. Oh, goodness. It makes it a breeze. It makes it enjoyable.
But also, I guess you need patient feedback, don't you? If you're communicating with them on a level that they feel comfortable, they're much more likely to tell you things that actually could really impact the treatment that you propose.
And as Raj says it, that whatever it was, I can't remember, a global dental collective about the GDC. He said if you build a relationship, you'll get less complaints.
I mean, I can see that it's true, because you don't want to complain about one of your friends. If they do something to you, you just kind of chat to them about it. Whereas if it's someone you don't like and you don't really know, then you can see how it's easier to just complain.
There's no investment.
Yeah, so I think, it's hard at dental school to add it in, but I definitely think in that foundation year, maybe more can be done to more studies on it, I guess.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because we do a course called The Blueprint, and we do it with Samir Patel, actually. Yeah. And one of the things that we have in it is 10,000 hours, because you said what we're all seeing is a lot of the young dentists, they want to do composite bonding and do all this stuff. And we were saying, you know, you need to do your 10,000 hours, you know, and if it's especially if it's in the NHS, because you talk to so many people that you will fine tune your communication skills, which is what you're saying, isn't it? You know, if you can, the more people you talk to, surprisingly enough, the better you get at it. You should get at it.
But I think there's a running theme here as well too. If you go back to kind of your school days and dental school and BACD, it doesn't surprise me at all that you communicate really well with your patients, because and as a result of that, you'll get good outcomes. But it's in a structured fashion. Yeah, it's not just chatting for the sake of it. Actually, there's a purpose behind it. But this is something that you've developed as a skill for many years, which I think it sounds like it's serving you incredibly well.
Yeah, I think it's also important just to highlight that it doesn't always go well, and I am still learning, and I have had instances with patients where my communication hasn't been great, and it has ended up with, I think I've had one major complaint, and when I go back to it, it was my communication. That's what it nestled down to. And it was nothing clinically that I'd done wrong. The clinical work was fine, but the thing she was complaining about, I actually got a call from the GDC. She went to the GDC about it, and it nestled down to I hadn't explained the treatment or what we were doing in a way that I understood it, but she obviously hadn't. So I hadn't. And that was on me. You learn so much from that. So I think it's important just to highlight, because I know that social media and everything, you see all the highs of everyone.
Definitely.
To be aware, like we all have mistakes, and we're all
composite bonding that fell off. Oops. So is Victoria Sampson, she would say the same, I think, wouldn't you say that? Because I think she's been public, hasn't she?
Yes.
Her complaint. Yeah. And I think hers was about communication.
Yeah.
Because she expected, like you just said, that you know, you're expecting people to be like you.
Mm.
And I think hers was very similar, wasn't it? She sort of expected the patient. I think she said because she felt she could help, that she could relate to everybody. But she said actually there are certain people you can't really relate to unless you can change the way you relate, if that makes sense.
And that's fine as well. Like, you're not going to be the best dentist for everyone. And that's the thing, if you don't get on. Like, there'll be someone out there who's a perfect fit.
You've got so much energy and passion for the profession. Is that passion going to transfer into owning a practice and leading your own team someday?
So I get asked this a lot. Do you know what? At the moment, I've got no, like, it's not, I've got some goals of what I want to achieve. Owning a practice isn't one.
It's down here.
It's, at the moment, I don't know, I love being kind of stuck in with the patients and doing my dentistry, and I'm really enjoying being a wet finger clinician at the moment. I'm learning a lot from being in my different practices about setting up a squat and how that works, and just the stress of being a principal work. I'm like, do I want to do that? I mean, I know it's very rewarding, and probably one day, I'm not saying I won't, but at the moment I've got no major ambition. I would love to.
And there's nothing wrong with not wanting to own a practice, is there?
It's not fun. I think it's a shame. Quite often people kind of always have this hierarchy of, you know, an associate and somehow a principal ranks above an associate.
It's just apologetic.
Yeah, and it's not the case. As a non-clinician, I'm in awe of dentists. I think what you do is truly life-changing. It is ridiculous. And sadly, in our other job, kind of selling dental practices, we often see people towards the end of their career. And it's always a bit sad when they've fallen out of love with dentistry, because it is such an incredible career. And I don't think any associate should ever feel apologetic. Saying, like, actually, I'm happy to do this. And I don't think there's ever been a better time to be an associate anyway, because, you know, it's an interesting profession. You can still have your own individual profile through social media platforms. Do you feel like you're a business person in your own right as an associate? Do you still feel like you're running a micro business yourself?
Yeah, to an extent. I'm starting to feel a little bit more like that. But I kind of feel like I found practices where I almost feel like the principal. Like, I feel like that practice is, I care about it and like it's mine, but without
the
headache and the stress and the paperwork and the staffing issues. So I'm quite enjoying kind of being on that side of things. But yes, I do. As I'm kind of progressing a little bit, I am feeling like, okay, I do need to focus on myself and my brand and who I'm putting out there as a clinician myself. But I still do feel kind of like that affinity and that tie to the practices, and as if
that's a credit to the principals, actually, to have made you feel that. Because that's a real good one, is the fact that you feel that engaged. Whereas obviously some associates don't feel engaged whatsoever. So it's a real credit to the guys that you're working with who've made you feel that investment.
Jack Welch said a thing about values, and he always says that the best people you can have in a team are people who are performing in terms of delivering the numbers. So in your world, you know, seeing patients, delivering a gross, but also get the culture and the values of the practice. If you get somebody in a business that performs at a kind of metric level, financial level, and somebody who gets the values and the culture, they are an absolute winner, and you want to keep those people all day long. And like I said, I think you tick that box, but as Chris says, I think it's also credit to the people you're working with. They're creating the environment that enables you to be that person.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, all of my principals are incredible, and I feel so lucky because they're so supportive, and I think
it's brilliant.
Such a key thing to find. And I have a lot of friends who aren't in the same position. I put it down to them and building the culture and the values and the team. It makes you feel like you're part of it. So, yeah.
But there again, I suppose, goes back to your networking that you were saying. You got those jobs you got through your networking. It all fits together, doesn't it? Brilliant. Really good.
It does.
Tilly, well done. Hands off.
We always wrap up in the same way. We've got two questions for you.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, she's readjusting herself.
Yeah, she's getting herself ready.
Serious stuff. So the first question we have for you is, if you could be the fly on a wall in a certain situation, when would that be and be there?
Okay, so I've actually got two. Am I allowed to?
Go on,
why not?
The first one that I just would find really interesting is, I hear so many stories from patients about how awful dentistry was 20, 30, 40 years ago, that I actually would find it really interesting to go and be a fly on the wall back then. Because I think we take for granted being a new graduate in these times, the technology that we have, anesthesia.
I could introduce you to my old dentist.
Yeah. I just think it would be really interesting and make us appreciate where we are. So that would also be interesting. And then the other one, that just because I'm super nosy, during kind of all the COVID, COVID goings on, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in like Partygate and seen what actually went on, and seen the goings on and whether they actually had a party and how much fun it was, and
and were they really pretending?
Yeah,
they were working. Exactly. Obviously,
my guess is they did have a party and they had a lot of fun.
And then, did you see that thing today though? And this will date this, but it doesn't matter really. That thing about Boris was contemplating a raid on drug supplies that have been embargoed in Belgium or Holland or something. Did you not read it? Brilliant. So, you know, there's some drugs, I don't know, whatever they were. It was AstraZeneca, wasn't it? So the EU were blockading drugs or something. So he asked the military to prepare a plan to have a raid to steal the drugs from this facility. Oh, yeah, I love it. COVID.
Absolutely ridiculous. And our follow-up question is, if you could meet somebody, you can sit down, have a glass of wine, a cup of coffee.
Living or dead?
Yes. Who would you like to meet? Who would you like to meet?
So I think I would like to meet, and I'm undecided on who, but one of the F1 drivers. I'm thinking Daniel Ricciardo, because he's so much fun.
He'd be fun.
He's so much
yep.
But he has that great balance of like focus, this is like for his race, there's nothing that can distract him. And then it's like the second he's out the car, it's banter, jokey, and he's back to his normal self. And I think that is such a skill, and he seems like such a lovely guy. That I think that would be a lot.
I imagine it's exhausting. I bet going out with him for a night is exhausting. I bet you need a week off to recover.
Oh, it's intense what they go through. But yeah, I think Daniel Ricciardo would be great.
Brilliant. Tilly, it's been a joy. I'm looking forward to doing another one of these in a few years' time, because I think there'll be lots of twists and turns in terms of where you are and what you're doing. But I think already so far you've done so much, and I think people will take so much from how you've approached your career and the success you've had. There's key kind of stepping stones that you've kind of used to get you to where you are. So it's been a
learning conversation.
Yes.
It's just a conversation. It's just a...
So thank you very much indeed. No doubt we'll be seeing one another soon at an event somewhere. But in the meantime, have a lovely day. Thank you for your time and look after yourself.
Yeah, lovely to see you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's lovely to chat. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Cheers, Jenny. Keep well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.